the thought. But you guys want to arrest Abood. Wouldn't that have the same effect as killing him? He'd be out of power and could not stop a civil war.
The thinking at the ICC is that if we could give Abood a reason to use his influence and power to our benefit, then his followers would not fall into the trap of being used as pawns by the Chinese and the Russians.
Interesting, thought Cort, but he saw no possible way Abood would have a reason to comply with the ICC. They crested a gentle rise, palm trees at the apex. On the other side, they saw the massive IDP camp splayed out in the valley below them, over several square miles. It was flat and dark in the night, thousands of single-room tents. There were lights around the perimeter, and a few UNAMID vehicles in view. Camel-dung fires burned like 100 fireflies in the distance, tiny pinpricks of amber across the wide valley floor.
"It's incredible," said Ellen, her hands on her hips.
"You see the gate?" asked Cort, pointing towards an entrance in the fencing, protected on either side by white-armored personnel carriers.
"Yeah,"
she looked up at him.
"You're not coming with me, are you?"
Cort mounted the Janjaweed horse. "Nope."
"Because of what I said about having you prosecuted? Look, you are safer in there than you are out here. You won't be taken into custody here in Dira, I promise you. We follow the law. You haven't even been indicted yet."
"I'm not going in there because I have a job to do out here, and I'm going to do it."
"So you just ride off into the sunset?"
"It's 12:30. Walsh shook her head, batted buzzing insects away from her eyes.
"I bet you think you are a cowboy, but you're not. You're an outlaw. You are..."
"I need 3 days, Ellen. 3 days from now, you can do whatever it is you have to do. Make your report. Send teams out looking for me."
"Why don't you tell me your mission? What happens in 3 days? Who are you working for? If our goals do intersect, I promise I will try to help you."
"No offense, Miss Walsh, but I don't need any help your organization can provide." She looked to the rifle on his chest and waved an exhausted hand at it.
"Again, that's all the help you need?"
"I'm not here to kill people. The last 24 hours, I have been off mission. Like I said, you would 100% approve of what I'm doing. I just need 3 days to do it. Your wait will be rewarded."
Walsh did not reply. Cort could imagine her giving him 3 days just out of curiosity. He could also imagine her running to the front gate of the SI camp and yelling at the UNAMID soldiers to get themselves into their jeeps to chase the white horsemen through the night. Ellen Walsh, like all women, was a complete mystery to Cort Gentry.
3 days, please.
He pulled the reins on the horse hard, spun the big animal around, and then galloped off into the dark. Chapter 28. Cort sat in his tiny hotel room in Al-Fasher. Outside the open window above his tattered and soiled mattress on the floor, the morning bustle of the city rattled and whistled and bleated and shouted as men and animals and vehicles passed by. He was filthy and wanted a shower, but there was no shower here, just a hole cut into a closet floor down the hall for a toilet. He'd spent the evening scratching bloody flea bites and had not gotten much sleep, but, he asked himself, what did he expect for nothing? It had taken a day and a half and most of the rest of his Sudanese pounds to get a car and a driver to transport him back to the capital of North Darfur. Cort bought a satellite phone with the rest of his cash, using his watch and the two AKs to make up the difference. The man who'd driven him from Dira had a cousin who owned a filthy boarding house in Al-Fasher for Darfuris there to work construction on whatever project the NGOs were paying them to build. And the driver and the cousin had spoken and offered Cort a room free of charge. The two men even took Cort shopping for some local items and paid for them out of their own pockets. Many Sudanese, Cort had noticed in his day on the road and in the town, possessed an intense kindness and willingness to give of themselves and their meager property for a complete stranger. Cort had little to offer in return but his gratitude, a few Arabic words of thanks, and an understanding of the body language of the culture. He held his hand to his heart and nodded deeply so many times in the past day, he almost felt as if he could pass for a Darfuri, if not for the pigmentation of his skin. Court had worked in dozens of different places in his career, either as a CIA singleton operator, as a CIA paramilitary operations officer, or as a private sector assassin, and many of those places, for want of a better term, sucked. But from time to time, he found himself somewhere remote, both geographically and culturally, and completely taken in by the scenery or the people or the way of life in ways that stayed with him after he'd done his job and left the place behind. He felt this way about Darfur. He wasn't supposed to be here. There was much to hate. It was hot as hell and thick with bugs and controlled by a despot and murdering bands of marauders. But Court felt something about this place, the people, the stubbornness and discipline needed to face a miserable day armed with nothing but one's own devices. He could not help but respect the people for scratching out what existences they had, and he appreciated their kindness to him. He would love to repay the kindness by removing the man from power who was systematically killing them. He reached across the mattress, picked up his phone, and called a number in St. Petersburg. Gregor Ivanovich Sidorenko had not slept. His man had disappeared into the depths of Darfur, the opposite side of the country from where he needed to be, and he had not heard from him in almost 72 hours. Furthermore, the international news channels were broadcasting reports from Darfur, reports of an attack on an aid convoy not 90 minutes driving time from where Gentry was last seen. Details were sketchy, but things did not look good. Sid sat at his breakfast table in the cold, bit into a hard-boiled egg, and stared at his phone. He'd hardly taken his beady eyes from it in 3 days. But for once it rang, and it startled him. The Russian mobster tipped a mimosa in a fluted crystal glass while lurching forward to grab the receiver, fresh-squeezed Florida orange juice, Cuvée de Saint-Air Grand Marnier, and Krug Grand Cuvée champagne drenching his thick, gold-lined fleece robe. He ignored the expensive mess and answered the phone.
Slushayu vas?
I am listening. It's Gray. You receiving me okay?
Mr. Gray, where are you?
I'm back in Alfasher. I'm safe at the moment, but I can't stay here for long.
What happened?
Nothing to worry about. I got sidetracked.
Said Mr. Gray, that is not acceptable. You have jeopardized everything. The FSB is very upset.
It couldn't be helped.
My people spoke to the pilot. You left the airport to save a woman. A woman!
Your pilot shouldn't have left me behind.
A woman!
It's more complicated.
This is a very serious damage to our timetable.
It's no problem.
How can you say that it is no problem? We do not have another flight to Khartoum scheduled until after Aboud's trip to the Red Sea. How are you going?
Can you get a plane back here to Alfasher?
Yes, I have arranged a flight. It will depart today from Belarus. But we can only get you out of the country with that flight. It will not be landing again in the Sudan.
It doesn't have to land.
I don't understand.
Get a pen and paper. I'm going to need the aircraft to bring in some gear I'll require if I'm going to continue on with the operation. Get the FSB to help you put it together. Just relax. This little hiccup along the way will be forgotten.
If they don't land, how will you...
They will need a flight path out of the country that takes them over the Red Sea. They can arrange that. Now write all this down. There was a scramble on the other end of the line.
Wait, okay, I am ready.
Court dictated a list to the Russian mob boss, who scribbled like a frantic secretary. When he was finished, Sidorenko blew out a long breath.
You can do this?
Sure.
The pilot, he can do it?
You will talk to him when we are in the air. Encourage him to follow my instructions to the letter.
Duh, of course.
Gregor Sidorenko was no longer angry. There was a high-pitched tone of excitement in his voice.
This will be dangerous for you.
You are worried about my well-being?
Of course. I just want to do what I can to help.
Anything else?
I had a man who was going to take you by car from Khartoum to Suakin. If you proceed as you suggest, you will have to cross territory all alone and on foot. You don't look like a Sudanese tribesman.
There is a tribe of lighter-skinned Arabs in the area, the Rashidas. I won't be able to pull it off up close, but with a head wrap and local clothing, someone seeing me driving in a car or walking across a field is going to peg me for a Rashida before he pegs me for a white boy.
You are willing to bet your life on that?
The assassin answered nonchalantly. This is what I do.
Sidorenko replied breathlessly.
You are amazing.
There was a long pause on the line. Sid thought the American was going to respond to his comment, but instead, he said,
The plan remains in effect. After I'm on the ground, no contact until the job is done.
Duh. But the man who is going to take you to Suakin, he is a police officer there in the city of Suakin. He is an occasional informant for the FSB. He may be able to provide you with intelligence that will be helpful. I can arrange a meeting.
Court thought it over. As far as Sid's op was concerned, he didn't really need a police informant. But for Zack's job, Nocturne Sapphire could absolutely stand for one more source of intel about the layout of forces in the area.
Agreed, Sid said.
Mr. Gray, please remember, I have women here for you, many beautiful women. Leave the ones you find in the desert. When you come back, you will never go wanting for women again.
Court sighed.
Why didn't I think of that?
Court leaned his head back against the plywood wall of his room. He knew he needed to call Zack. He'd put it off as long as possible. He knew he'd get a tongue-lashing of the highest order. He was right. After three rings, Zack answered the phone with a marked absence of the customary pleasantries.
What the fuck, dude?
I got delayed.
You got delayed? Really? Delayed? Good. I'm glad that's all it was, because for a minute there I was worried that maybe my watch was running two motherfucking days fast.
I got caught up with the NSS and the Janjaweed.
The NSS and the Janjas?
You left the airport. Yeah.
This wouldn't happen to have anything to do with some Canadian skank working for the ICC, would it?
She spread the word, huh?
She didn't spread the word. Mushroom clouds over NGO convoys spread the word. You must have charmed the socks off of her. She is saying she doesn't even remember what you look like. But the Darfuris are saying some lily-white fuckwad blew up two of their trucks and killed a shitload of Janjaweed. What the hell were you doing?
She needed my help.
Yeah? Outstanding. But you know what? I need your help, too. I need you to do your goddamn job, chasing tail across the desert when you are supposed to be over here getting ready for the most important SAD-SOG operation in the past decade is not going to get the shoot on site rescinded, Six.
I wasn't chasing tail. They were going to kill her.
Cry me a fucking river. As a matter of fact, cry me a fucking Nile River, because me and the boys almost had to fucking swim the Nile to get over there to pull your ass out of Darfur.
Court knew the possibility that the CIA would send Whiskey Sierra into Darfur to save Sierra 6 had never been on the table. It was a ludicrous assertion. Still, he also knew when it was best to just let Sierra 1 have his little rant unopposed. Like a forest fire that burns the mountain so thoroughly that no tinder remains to fuel it, Zack's tirade would extinguish itself in a minute if Court didn't fight back.
Look, said Court, already tired of talking to Zack. Everything is okay. Sid is sending a plane here to Al-Fasher tonight. I'll be in Suakin by tomorrow evening. I'll be back on target in time for the op Sunday morning at 6:30. Everything goes ahead as planned.
You'd better see that it does, dude. You better get back on target post-haste. There is a hell of a lot riding on this.
Yeah. Understood. Six out.
Chapter 29. Court kept his eye on the properly functioning GPS computer on his new wristwatch while sitting on the bench in the back of the Antonov. It gave him his position over the land below him, and he had to monitor it constantly to be sure the pilot was doing what he was told. The plane was an AN-26, a much smaller transport than the one he'd ridden into the Sudan 3 days earlier. He wondered how many people were on board. He hadn't seen or spoken to anyone in the cockpit since climbing onto the flight nearly 2 hours earlier. He'd been waiting at the end of the runway at Al-Fasher Airport, had spent 4 hours swatting flies and kicking away little scorpions and dinner plate-sized camel spiders, lying in a hide provided by one of the broken wings of one of the broken planes that lay like slaughtered birds alongside the runway. He'd planned on waiting inside the cabin of the discarded wreckage, but found the interior too hot and stuffy to bear, and he had no doubt there'd be snakes to contend with as well. He was down to his last bottle of water when he climbed the fence to get into the airport that afternoon, had drunk the last sip from it an hour before the Russian plane landed, which turned out to be nearly 3 hours before the plane took off again. He climbed through the hatch that they'd left open on his orders, relayed through Sid, through the FSB, and then on to the Rosa Barone export crew. When he made his way inside the dim cargo cabin, he found all the gear he'd requested cinched to a mesh bench. It was the same pack he'd had with him on his earlier flight, with a few new items, equipment crucial to the change in his operation necessitated by his 3-day visit to Darfur. The crew of the Antonov had not bothered to even come out of the cockpit to check and make sure he'd made it in, that he had everything he needed. These Russians didn't give a shit about him or his job. They were probably annoyed about the unusual flight plan they were ordered to fly, were certainly pissed about the unusual maneuver they'd have to execute, and they would no doubt blame him for the FSB heavies getting in their business and telling them how to do their job. As far as the man in the back of their plane right now, they made it 100% clear, with the open hatch left unattended and the lack of a welcoming party when he boarded. They didn't want to know him. And that worked for a guy like the Gray Man. He'd spent the first hour of the flight obsessively checking and rechecking all the equipment. He didn't trust these Russians with his life, so he didn't trust them to properly check the devices he'd need to keep himself alive and fulfill his objectives for the next 48 hours. Once he was satisfied everything was in working order, he sat back down on the bench and tried to relax. Court's brain soon drifted off mission. He wanted a pain pill, but he was in no pain. His adrenaline was up. It stayed high when he was about to do this sort of thing, but still, he thought, he worried. He fretted now, more than earlier in his career. He'd once been a well-oiled machine, back with the SAD and before. Somehow, the Canadian woman had gotten inside him. He'd known better than to engage her in conversation, to try to justify himself to her. But there was something about her that got under his skin, in ways both positive and negative. He would never admit to respecting her, her line of work and sanctimony he absolutely did not agree with. But he did not meet many real people out here in the black, on the dark side. And even though she was likely some tree-hugging, do-gooding, we-are-the-world-singing, flipper-fucking fool, she was at least a fool who went toe-to-toe with the real dangers of the world. The aircraft began a steep descent, sending his stomach up into his chest, and Court unlatched the buckle on his seatbelt. Ellen Walsh pushed some of Gentry's buttons during their day together, and even though this woman was likely right now preparing an indictment and opening an investigation and putting all of her energies into tracking him down and seeing that he was thrown in some cage somewhere, Court couldn't say that he did not want to see her again. He shook his head. Shit, man, snap out of it. The Antonov leveled out quickly, causing Court's stomach to lurch in the other direction. With a metallic motorized cranking sound, the rear loading hatch opened behind him. Cold night sky appeared out past the red cabin lighting. The whoosh of air was audible, painfully loud even, but barely felt, as the aerodynamics of the craft kept the wind outside the cabin. Yes, he'd once been a well-oiled machine. Court stood, fumbled with all the equipment strapped to his body, and began lumbering towards the night. He was still a machine, he told himself, and he believed it. He knew it. He was just a machine that needed a bit more oil than in the old days. The Gray Man gave a quick test pull to the gear on his chest, between his knees, and on his back, walked slowly down the ramp, and tumbled out into the black sky. The night air was cool here near the east coast of the Sudan. Gentle breezes pulled in from the ocean saw to that. This area of the Red Sea Hills, the topographical anomaly to the west of Port Sudan and to the northwest of Swakin, rose 1,000 feet out of the Sawhill, a rocky brown disfigurement to the otherwise flat landscape. At 12:30, no light shone on the hillside save for a sliver of moon, not a single electrical source for a dozen miles in any direction, but these hills were not uninhabited. The Bejas and the Rashidas lived out here. They tended goats or small farms on the plateaus, traded at the souks in Port Sudan or Swakin, subsistence farmed where they could, lived off the hard earth, and did their best to stay out of the way of the Arabs, the tribes that had the power and led the government of Sudan. There was once gold in these hills. Since pharaonic times, gold ore had been sought out and mined and transported overland to Alexandria and Cairo. The mining of precious metals in the area had all but dried up, but gypsum and iron ore and limestone were still scratched out of the rock and sent away to places that actually had a need for the raw materials used in constructing cities and buildings. It certainly wasn't needed here. There'd been a war a few years back, like the war in southern Sudan and the war in Darfur. The eastern minority tribes once tried to throw off the yoke of oppression. They were poorly organized, all but unfunded, and slapped into submission in what had become little more than a footnote after the bigger, badder civil conflicts at the other ends of the large nation. Now, on a cool, dark